he saw across the world. He checked his emails to see that Uda had complied with his instructions on the banking business. Strictly speaking, he could have just let the Visa accounts die, but then some officious bank employee might have poked around to see why the last set of bills had not been paid. Better, he thought, to leave some surplus cash in the account, and to leave the account active but dormant, because a bank would not mind having surplus cash in its electronic vault, and if that account went dormant, no bank employee would do any investigation into it. Such things happened all the time. He made sure that the account number and access code remained hidden on his computer in a document only he knew about. He considered sending a letter of thanks to his Colombian contacts, but non-essential messages were a waste of time and an invitation to vulnerability. You didn't send messages for fun or for good manners, only what was strictly necessary and as brief as possible. He knew enough to fear the American ability to gather electronic intelligence. The Western news media often talked about intercepts, and so his organization had sworn completely off the satellite phones they'd used for convenience. Instead, they most often used messengers, who relayed information they'd carefully memorized. It was inconveniently slow, but it had the virtue of being completely secure. Unless the messenger was corrupted somehow, nothing was totally secure. Every system had its weaknesses. But the Internet was the best thing going. Individual accounts were beautifully anonymous, since they could be set up by anonymous third parties, and their identities relayed to the real end users, and therefore they existed only as electrons or photons, as alike as grains of sand in the empty quarter, as secure and anonymous as anything could be. And there were literally billions of Internet messages every day. Perhaps Allah could keep track of them, but only because Allah knew the mind and heart of every man, a capability he had not granted even to the faithful. And so Muhammad, who rarely stayed in the same location for more than 3 days, felt free to use his computer at will. The British Secret Service, its headquarters located at Thames House, upriver from the Palace of Westminster, maintained literally hundreds of thousands of wiretaps. The privacy laws of the United Kingdom were a lot more liberal than those of the United States, for the agencies of the state, that is, four of which applied to Uda bin Sali. The British Secret Service, its headquarters located at Thames House, upriver from the Palace of Westminster, maintained literally hundreds of thousands of wiretaps. The privacy laws of the United Kingdom were a lot more liberal than those of the United States, for the agencies of the state, that is, four of which applied to Uda bin Sali. One of those was for his cellular phone, and rarely developed much of anything valuable. His electronic accounts at work in the financial district and at home were the most valuable, since he distrusted voice communications and preferred electronic mail for all of his important contacts with the outside world. This included letters to and from home, mostly to reassure his father that the family money was secure. Strangely, he didn't even trouble himself to use an encryption program, assuming that the sheer volume of message traffic on the net would preclude official surveillance. Besides, there were many people in the capital preservation business in London. A lot of the city's valuable real estate was actually titled to foreigners, and money trafficking was something that even most of the players found boring. The money alphabet had only a few elements after all, and its poetry did little to move the soul. But his email line never chirped without an echo chirp at Thames House. And those fragments of signals went to GCHQ, Government Communications Headquarters at Cheltenham, north and west of London, from which they were relayed via satellite to Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and from there to Fort Meade, Maryland, via fiber-optic cable, for inspection mainly by one of the supercomputers in the headquarters building's enormous and strangely dungeon-like basement. From there, material regarded as important went to CIA's Langley, Virginia headquarters, after transiting a certain building's flat roof, after which the signals were digested by yet another set of computers. "Something new here from Mr. 56, Junior said almost to himself, meaning 56moha@eurocom.net. He had to think for a few seconds. It was mostly numbers. But one of the numbers was the electronic address of a European commercial bank. Mr. 56 wanted some money, or so it appeared, and now that they knew that Mr. 56 was a player, they had a new bank account to look at. That would happen the following day. It might even develop a name and a mailing address, depending on the individual bank's in-house procedures, but probably not. All the international banks were gravitating toward identical procedures, the better to maintain their competitive advantages, one over the other, until the playing field was as flat as a football pitch, as everyone adopted the most depositor-friendly procedures possible. Every person had his own version of reality, but everyone's money was equally green. Or orange, in the case of the euro, decorated as it was with buildings never built and bridges never crossed. Jack made appropriate notes and shut his machine down. He'd be having dinner tonight with Brian and Dominic, just to catch up with family stuff. There was a new seafood restaurant on US 29 that he wanted to check out, and his working day was done. Jack made a few notes for the next Monday morning. He didn't expect to be in on Sunday, national emergency or not. Uda bin Saleh merited a very close examination. Exactly how close, he wasn't sure. Though he'd begun to suspect that Saleh would be meeting one or two people he knew well. How soon? It had been a bad question from Brian Caruso, but coming from Hendley's mouth, it had rather more immediacy. Well, we have to put a plan of some sort together, Sam Granger replied. For everyone here, it was the same. What had been a slam dunk in the abstract became more complex when you had to face the reality of it. First, we need a set of targets who make sense, and then a plan for servicing them in a way that also makes some sort of sense. Operational concept? Tom Davis wondered aloud. The idea is to move logically, from our point of view, but to an outsider it should appear random, from target to target, making people stick their heads up like prairie dogs so as we can take them one at a time. It's simple enough in concept, but more difficult in the practical world. It was a lot easier to move chess pieces around a board than it was to manage people to move on command to the squares desired, a fact often lost on movie directors. Something as prosaic as a missed bus connection or a traffic accident or the need to take a piss could play hell with the most elegant theoretical plan. The world, one had to remember, was analog, not digital in the way it operated. And analog actually meant sloppy. So are you saying we need a psychiatrist? Sam shook his head. They have some of those at Langley. It hasn't helped them very much. Ain't that the truth? Davis laughed, but this was not a time for humor. Speed, he observed. Yes, the faster the better, Granger agreed. Deny them the time to react and think. Also, better to deny them the ability to know anything's going on, said Henley. Make people disappear. Too many people have apparent heart attacks, and somebody'll get suspicious. You suppose they have any of our agencies penetrated? The former senator wondered aloud. The other two in the room winced at the suggestion. Depends on what you mean, Davis took the question. A penetration agent? That would be hard to arrange, absent a really juicy bribe, and even then it would be hard to set up, unless the agency had a guy who went to them looking for a bankroll. Maybe that is a possibility, he added after a moment's reflection. The Russians were always niggardly with money. They didn't have that much hard currency to toss around. These people, hell, they have more than they need. So, maybe. But that works for us, Hendley thought. Not too many people at the agency know we exist. So if they start thinking CIA is offing people, they can use their penetration agent, if any, to tell them it's not happening. So then their expertise is counterproductive to them, Granger speculated. They'd think Mossad, wouldn't they? Who else? Davis asked in return. Their own ideology works against them. It had been a ploy rarely, but sometimes successfully used against KGB. Nothing like making the other guy feel clever. And if it made it tough for the Israelis, nobody in the American intelligence community would lose much sleep over it. Ally or not, the Israelis were not entirely beloved by their American counterparts. Even the Saudi spooks played with them, because national interests often overlapped in the most unlikely of ways. And for this series of plays, Americans would be looking out only for the mother country, and doing so completely off the books. The targets we have identified, where are they? Handley asked. All in Europe. They tend to be bankers or communications people. They move money around, or they handle messages, do briefings. One seems to gather intelligence. He travels a lot. Maybe he scouted locations for yesterday, but we haven't been on him long enough to know. We have some targets who do comms, but we want to leave those alone. They're too valuable. The other concern is to avoid targets whose demise will tell the opposition how we twig to them. It has to appear random. I think for some we set it up in such a way that the opposition think they've gone over the hill. Took the money and bugged out. Grabbed a piece of the good life and dropped off the earth. We can even leave email messages like that behind. And if they have a code to show it's their messages and not somebody who's taken charge of their computers? Davis asked. That works for us as much as it works against us. It's a natural play to arrange your disappearance in such a way as to suggest you've been whacked. Nobody's going to come looking for a dead man, right? They must have that kind of concern. They hate us for corrupting their society, and so they must know that their people can be corrupted. They will have brave ones, and they'll have cowardly ones. These people are not unified in their outlook. They're not robots. Some will be true believers, sure, but others are in it for the ride, the fun, the glamour of what they're doing. But when it comes to the nut-crunching time, life will be more attractive to them than death. Granger knew people and motivations, and no, they were not robots. In fact, the smarter they were, the less likely they were to be motivated by the simple. Most of the Muslim extremists, interestingly enough, were either in Europe or had been educated there. In a comfortable womb, they'd been isolated by their ethnic background, but also liberated from the repressive societies from which they'd sprung. Revolution had always been a creature of rising expectations, not a product of oppression, but a proto-liberation. It was a time of personal confusion, and a time for seeking after identity, a period of psychological vulnerability when an anchor was needed and grasped at, whatever the anchor happened to be. It was sad to have to kill people who were more lost than anything else. But they'd chosen their path freely, if not intelligently. And if that path led to the wrong place, that was not the fault of their victims, was it? The fish was pretty good. Jack tried the rockfish, the striped bass of the Chesapeake Bay. Brian opted for the salmon, and Dominic the crusted sea perch. Brian had chosen the wine, a French white from the Loire Valley. So how the hell did you get here? Dominic asked his cousin. I looked around, and this place interested me, so I looked into it. And the more I found out, the less I could figure out. So I came over and talked to Jerry, and I talked my way into a job. Doing what? They call it analysis. It's more like mind reading. One guy in particular, Arabian name, plays with money in London. Mainly family money, dicks around with it, mainly trying to protect his father's pile. It's a nice pile, Jack assured his companions. He trades real estate. Nice way to preserve capital. The London market isn't going down anytime soon. The Duke of Westminster is one of the richest guys in the world. He owns most of central London. Our little friend is emulating his grace. What else? What else is that he's fed money into a certain bank account that's the source of payment for a bunch of Visa cards, four of whose owners you guys met yesterday. It wasn't a completed circle yet, but that wouldn't take the FBI much longer to close it up tight. He also talked in his emails about the wonderful events of yesterday. How did you get access to his emails? Dominic asked. I can't say. You'll have to get that from somebody else. About 10 miles that way, I bet, Dominic said, pointing northeast. The spook community tended to work on lines that were ordinarily forbidden to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. In any case, Cousin Jack just maintained a fairly blank look that would not have won him any money at a high-stakes poker table. So, he funds bad guys? Brian asked. Correct. That does not make him a good guy. Brian developed the thought a little further. Probably not, Junior agreed. Maybe we'll meet him. What else can you tell us? Brian continued. Expensive place, a townhouse on Berkeley Square, nice part of London, couple of blocks from the U.S. Embassy. Likes to use whores for his sexual recreation. He especially likes one girl named Rosalie Parker. The British Security Service keeps an eye on him, and they regularly debrief his main squeeze, the Parker girl. He pays her top dollar in cash. Miss Parker is supposed to be popular with rich people. I suppose she slings it pretty good, Jack added with distaste. There's a new photo on the computer file. He's about our age. Olive complexion, sort of beard. The kind a guy might have to look sexy, you know? Drives an Aston Martin. Hot car. Usually goes around London in cabs, though. He doesn't have a place in the country, but he takes country trips on weekends to getaway hotels, mostly with Miss Parker or another rent-abroad. Works downtown in the financial district. Has an office in the Lloyds of London building, third floor, I think. He makes 3 or 4 trades per week. Mainly, I think he just sits there and watches the TV and stock tickers, reads the papers, stuff like that. So he's a spoiled rich kid who wants some excitement in his life, Dominic summarized. Correct. Except maybe he likes to go out and play in the traffic. That's dangerous, Jack, Brian pointed out. It could even get somebody Excedrin headache number 356. Brian was wearing his game face, in anticipation of meeting the guy who would finance the death of David Prentice. And suddenly Jack thought that Miss Rosalie Parker of London might not be getting all that many more Louis Vuitton bags. Well, she probably had a nice retirement plan already arranged, if she was as smart as the security service and special branch thought she was. How's your dad doing? Dominic asked. Writing his memoirs, Jack answered. I wonder how much he'll be able to put in. You know, even Mom doesn't know much about what he did at CIA, and the little bit I know, well, there's a lot of stuff he can't write about. Even the things that are sort of out in the public eye, he can't confirm they really happened. Like getting the head of the KGB to defect. That's got to be some story. That guy's been on TV. I guess he's still pissed at your dad for keeping him from taking the Soviet Union over. Probably thinks he could have saved it. Maybe so. Dad has a lot of secrets, all right. So do some of his pals from the agency. One guy in particular named Clark. Scary guy, but him and Dad are pretty tight. I think he's in England now. Boss of that new secret counterterrorism bunch that the press talks about every year or so. The Men of Black, they call them. They're real, Brian said. Out at Hereford in Wales. They're not that secret. The senior guys from Force Recon have been out there to train with them. Never been there myself, but I know 2 guys who have. Them and the Brit SAS. They're serious troops. How far inside were you, Aldo? His brother asked. Hey, the special operations community is pretty tight. We cross-train, share new equipment and stuff. Most important part is when we sit down with beers and share war stories. Everybody has a different way of looking at problems, and, you know, sometimes the other guy has a better idea than you have. The Rainbow Team, that's the men of black the newsies talk about, they're very smart, but they've learned a thing or two from us over the years. Thing is, they're smart enough to listen to new ideas. The boss man, this Clark guy, he's supposed to be very smart. He is. I've met him. Dad thinks he's the cat's ass. He paused before going on. Hendley knows him, too. Why he isn't here, I don't know. I asked the first day I came here. Maybe because he's too old. He's a shooter? I asked Dad once. Dad said he couldn't say. That's how he says yes. I guess I caught him at a weak moment. Funny thing about Dad, he can't lie worth a damn. I guess that's why he loved being president so much. Yeah, I think that's the main reason he quit. He figured Uncle Robbie could handle it better than he did. Until that cracker bastard wasted his ass, Dominic observed. The shooter, one Dwayne Farmer, was currently sitting on death row in Mississippi. The last of the Klan, the newspapers called him. And so he was. At age 68, just a damn-by-everybody bigot who could not abide the thought of a black president and had used his grandfather's World War I revolver to make it so. That was bad, John Patrick Ryan Jr. agreed. You know, except for him, I wouldn't have been born. It's a big family story. Uncle Robbie's version of it was pretty good. He loved telling stories. Him and Dad were pretty tight. After Robbie got wasted, the political pukes were running around in circles. Some of them wanted Dad to pick up the flag again, like, but he didn't do it. And so I guess he helped that Keelty guy get elected. Dad can't stand him. That's the other thing he never learned, how to be nice to people he hates. He just didn't like living at the White House very much. He was good at it, being president, Dominic thought. You tell him that. Mom didn't mind leaving either. That First Lady stuff wrecked her doctor work, and she really hated what it did with Kyle and Katie. You know that old saying, the most dangerous place in the world is between a mom and her kids? It's for real guys. Only time I ever saw her lose her temper, Dad does that a lot more than Mom does, was when somebody told her that her official duties required her not to go to Kyle's pageant at his daycare center. Jeez, she really came unglued. Anyway, the nannies helped, and the news people hammered her about that, how it wasn't American and all that. You know, if anybody had ever taken a picture of Dad taking a piss, I bet someone would have said he wasn't doing it right. That's what critics are for, to tell you how much smarter they are than the person they're criticizing. In the Bureau, Aldo, they're called lawyers, or the Office of Professional Responsibility, Dominic informed the table. They have their sense of humor surgically removed before they join up. The Marines have reporters, too, and I bet not one of them ever went through boot camp. At least the guys who worked in the IG had been through the basic school. I guess we should cheer up, Dominic announced, holding up his wine glass. Ain't nobody gonna criticize us. And live, Jack added with a chuckle. Damn, he thought. What the hell is Dad gonna say when he finds out about me? Chapter 16 And the Pursuing Horses. Sunday was a day of rest for most people, and at the campus it was much the same. Except for the security people. Jerry Hendley believed that maybe God had a point, that seven-day schedules accomplished a lot less than adding 16.67% to a man's weekly productivity. It also dulled the brain by denying it free-form exercise, or just the luxury of doing nothing at all. But today it was different, of course. Today they'd be planning real black operations for the first time. The campus had been active just over 19 months, and that time had mostly been spent in establishing their cover as a trading and arbitrage business. His department heads had taken the Acela trains back and forth to New York many times to meet their white world counterparts. And though it had seemed slow at the time, In retrospect, it had been very quickly indeed that they had made their reputation in the money management community. They'd hardly ever shown the world their real results, of course, from speculating on currencies and a few very carefully chosen stock issues. Sometimes even insider trades on companies which themselves didn't know the business that was coming their way. Staying covert had been the overall objective. But since the campus had to be self-supporting, it also had to generate real income. In World War II, the Americans had peopled its black operations establishments with lawyers, while the Brits had used bankers. Both had proven to be good for screwing people and killing them. It had to be something about the way they looked at the world, Hendley thought over his coffee. He gazed at the others. Jerry Rounds, his head of strategic planning, Sam Granger, his chief of operations. Even before the building had been completed, the three of them had been thinking about the shape of the world and how a few of the corners could best be rounded off. Rick Bell was here, too, his chief of analysis, the one who spent his working days sorting through the take from NSA and CIA and trying to find meaning in the flood of unrelated information, aided, of course, by the 35,000 analysts at Langley, Fort Meade, and other such places. Like all senior analysts, he also liked to frolic in the operations playground, and here that was actually possible, since the campus was too small to have been overtaken by its own bureaucracy. He and Hendley worried that it might not always be so, and both made sure that no empires were being built. To the best of their knowledge, theirs was the only institution in all the world like this. And it had been set up in such a way that it could be erased from the landscape in a matter of 2 or 3 months. Since Hendley Associates did not invite outside investors, their public profile was low enough that the radar never spotted their machinations, and in any case, the community they were in did not advertise. It was easy to hide in a field in which everyone did the same, and nobody ratted on anyone else, unless very badly stung. And the campus didn't sting. At least not with money. So, Hendley began. Are we ready? Yes, Round said for Granger. Sam nodded soberly and smiled. We're ready, Granger announced officially. Our two boys have earned their spurs in a way we never anticipated. They earned them all right, Bell agreed. And the Ryan boy has identified a good first target, this Solly fellow. The events of Friday have generated a lot of message traffic. They turn out a lot of cheerleaders. A lot of them are stringers and wannabes, but even if we pop one of them by mistake, it's no great loss. I have the first four all lined up. So, Sam, do you have a plan for dealing with them? That was Davis's cue. We're going to do reconnaissance by fire. After we whack one or two, we'll see what reaction, if any, results, and we'll take our guidance from there. I agree that Mr. Solly looks like a profitable first target. Question is his elimination going to be overt or covert? Explain, Hendley ordered. Well, if he's found dead on the street, that's one thing. If he disappears with his daddy's money and leaves behind a note saying that he wants to stop what he's doing and just retire, that's something else, Sam explained. Kidnapping. It's dangerous. The Metropolitan Police in London had a closure rate on kidnappings that nibbled at 100%. That was a dangerous game to play, especially on their first move. Well, we can hire an actor, dress him upright, fly him to New York, Kennedy, and then just have him disappear. In fact, we dispose of the body and keep the money. How much does he have access to, Rick? Direct access? Hell, it's over $300 million. Might look good in the corporate exchequer, Sam speculated. And it wouldn't hurt his dad much, would it? His father's money? All of it? Try the sunny side of $3 billion, Bell answered. He'll miss it, but it wouldn't break him. And given his opinion of his son, it might even develop as good cover for our operation, he hypothesized. I am not recommending this as a course of action, but it is an alternative, Granger concluded. It had been talked about before, of course. It was too obvious a play to escape notice, and $300 million would have looked just fine in a campus account, say in the Bahamas or Liechtenstein. You could hide money anywhere that had telephone lines. It was just electrons anyway, not gold bricks. Hendley was surprised that Sam had brought this up so soon. Maybe he wanted to get a read on his colleagues. They were clearly not overcome with emotion at the thought of ending this Solly's life, but to steal from him in the process pushed some very different buttons. A man's conscience could be a funny thing, Jerry concluded. Let's set that aside for the moment. How hard will the hit be? Hendley asked. With what Rick Pasternak gave us? It's child's play, so long as our people don't make a complete hash of it. Even then, the worst thing that can happen is that it'll look like a mugging that went wrong, Granger told them. What if our guy drops the pen? Rounds worried. It's a pen. You can write with it. It'll pass inspection with any cop in the world, Granger replied confidently. He reached in his pocket and passed his sample around the table. This one's cold, he assured them. They'd all been briefed in. To all appearances, it was an expensive ballpoint, gold-plated with obsidian on the clip. By depressing the clip and turning the nib cover, you switched the point from a real pen to a hypodermic with a lethal transfer agent. It would paralyze the victim in 15 to 20 seconds and kill him in 3 minutes, with no cure, and a very transient signature in the body. As the pen went around the conference table, the executives invariably felt the hypo point, and then experimented with using it for a simulated hit, mostly as an ice-pick strike, though Rounds handled it like a diminutive sword. It would be nice to try it on a dry run, he observed quietly. Anyone here want to volunteer as the victim? Granger asked the table. No heads nodded. The mood of the room didn't surprise him much. It was time for a sober pause, the sort of thing that comes over a man when he signs his application for life insurance, a product that is valuable only if you are dead, which rather takes the fun out of the moment. Fly them to London together? Hendley asked. Correct, Granger nodded, and turned back to his business voice. We have them scout out the target, pick their moment, and make their hit. And wait to see the results, Rounds asked rhetorically. Correct. Then they can fly off to the next target. The whole operation should not take more than a week. Then we fly them home and await developments. If somebody taps into his money pile after his demise, we'll probably know, right? We ought to, Bell confirmed. And if anyone purloins it, we'll know where it goes. Excellent, Granger observed. After all, that was what reconnaissance by fire meant. They wouldn't be here long, the twins both thought. They were quartered in adjoining rooms at the local Holiday Inn, and this Sunday afternoon they were both watching TV with one guest. How's your mom? Jack asked. Fine. Doing a lot of stuff with the local schools, parochial ones. A little more than a teacher's aide, but not actually teaching. Dad's working some new project. Supposedly Boeing is back looking at an SST, supersonic airliner. Dad says they'll probably never build it, unless Washington coughs up a lot of money. But with the Concorde retired, people are thinking about it again, and Boeing likes to keep their engineers busy. They're a little nervous about the Airbus people, and they don't want to be caught with their pants down if the French start getting ambitious. How is the Corps? Jack asked Brian. The Corps is the Corps, cuz. It just rolls along, keeping busy for the next war that'll come along. Dad was worried when you went to Afghanistan. It was a little exciting. The people there, they're tough, and they're not dumb, but they're not trained that well either. So, when we bumped heads with them, we came out ahead. If we saw something that looked hinky, we called air in on it, and that usually took care of things. How many? How many did we take out? Some. Not enough, but some. The Green Berets went in first. and the Afghans learned from that that a stand-up fight was not in their interest. Mostly we did pursuit and reconnaissance, bird-dogging for the Airedales. We had a CIA guy with us, and a signals intelligence detachment. The bad guys used their radios a little too much. When we got a hit, we'd move into about a mile or so and give it a look-see. And if it was interesting enough, we'd call in air and scramble the hell out of it. Scary to watch, Brian summarized. I bet. Jack popped open a can of beer. So, this Solly guy, the one with the girlfriend, Rosalie Parker? Dominic asked. Like most cops, he had a good memory for names. You said that he was jumping up and down about the shootings? Yep, Jack said. Thought they were just swell. So who was the cheerleading with? Pals he emails to. The Brits have his phones tapped, and the emails, well, as I said, I can't tell you about the emails. Those European phone systems aren't anywhere near as secure as people think. I mean, everybody knows about intercepting cell phones and stuff, but the cops over there pull stuff we can't do here. The Brits especially, they use intercepts to track the IRA guys. I heard that the rest of the European countries are even freer to act. They are, Dominic assured him. At the academy, we had some in the National Academy program. That's like a doctoral course for cops. They talk about that sort of thing after you got a few drinks into them. So this Solly guy liked what those mutts did, eh? Like his team won the Super Bowl, Jack replied at once. And he bankrolls them? Brian asked. That's right. Interesting, was all Brian had to say after getting that question answered. He could have stayed another night, but he had things to do in the morning, and so he was driving back to London in his Aston Martin Vanquish, Boland Black. Its interior was charcoal, and its handmade 12-cylinder engine was pushing out most of its 460 horsepower as he headed east on the M4 at 100 miles per hour. In its way, the car was better than sex. It was a pity Rosalie wasn't with him, but he looked over at his companion. Mandy was an agreeable bed-warmer, if a little too skinny for his usual tastes. If only she could put some meat on her bones. But European fashion did not encourage that. The fools who determined the rules of women's bodies were probably pederasts, who wished them all to look like young boys. Madness, Solly thought. Pure madness. But Mandy enjoyed riding in this car more than Rosalie did. Rosalie, sadly, was fearful of driving fast, not as trusting of his skills as she should have been. He hoped he could take this car home. He'd fly it there, of course. His brother had a fast car of his own, but the dealer had told him that this four-wheeled rocket topped out at over 300 kilometers per hour. That was 196 miles per hour. And the kingdom had some fine, flat, straight roads. Okay, so he had a cousin who flew Tornado fighters for the Royal Saudi Air Force, but this car was his, and that made all the difference. Unfortunately, the police here in England would not allow him to exercise it properly. One more traffic ticket and he might lose his driver's license, spoil sports. But at home there would be no such problems. And after seeing what it could really do, he'd fly it back to Gatwick and use it to excite women, which was almost as good as just driving it. Certainly Mandy was properly excited by it. He'd have to give her a nice Vuitton bag and have it messengered to her flat tomorrow. It didn't hurt to be generous with women, and Rosalie needed to learn that she had some competition. Racing into town as rapidly as the traffic and the police allowed, he zoomed past Harrods, through the vehicle tunnel, and past the Duke of Wellington's house before turning right onto Curzon Street and then left onto Berkeley Square. A flash of his lights told the man he paid to guard his parking place to move his car, and he was able to park just in front of his three-story brownstone townhouse. With continental manners, he got out of the car and raced around to open Mandy's door and gallantly escorted her up the steps to the huge oak front door, and, smiling, held it open for her. In a few minutes, she'd be opening an even nicer door for him, after all. "The little bug is back," Ernest observed, making the proper note of the time on his clipboard. The two security service officers were in a British Telecom van parked 50 yards away. They'd been there for about 2 hours. This young, stouty madman drove as though he were the reincarnation of Jimmy Clark. "I suppose he had a better weekend than we did," Peter agreed. Then he turned to punch the buttons to activate various wiretap systems in the Georgian townhouse. These included 3 cameras whose tapes were collected every third day by a penetration team. "He is a vigorous little bastard. Probably uses Viagra," Ernest thought aloud, and somewhat enviously. "One must be a good sport, Ernie, my lad. It'll cost him 2 weeks of our pay. And for what she's about to receive, she will surely be truly grateful." "Bugger," Ernest observed sourly. "She's thin, but not that thin, boyo." Peter had himself a good laugh. They knew what Mandy Davis charged her tricks, and like men everywhere, they wondered what special thing she might do to earn it, all the while holding her in contempt. As counterintelligence officers, they did not quite have the degree of sympathy a seasoned police constable might have had for relatively unskilled women trying to earn their way. £750 for an evening's visit and £2,000 for a complete night. Exactly what her custom was for a full weekend, no one had asked. They both picked up the earphones to make sure the microphones worked, switching channels to track them through the house. "He's an impatient sod," Ernest observed. "Suppose she'll stay the night?" "I'll wager she doesn't, Annie. And maybe he'll get on the bloody phone and we can get something useful off the bastard." "Bloody wog," Ernest muttered, to his partner's agreement. They both thought Mandy was prettier than Rosalie. Fit for a government minister. They were correct in their judgment. Mandy left at 10:23 a.m., stopping at the door for one last kiss and a smile certain to break any man's heart. And then she walked downhill on Berkeley Street, heading toward Piccadilly, where she did not turn right at the Boots drugstore for the underground station on the corner of Piccadilly and Stratton, but rather caught a cab that took her downtown to New Scotland Yard. There she'd be debriefed by a friendly young detective, whom she rather fancied, though she was too skilled in her profession to mix business of the business sort with business of the pleasure sort. Uda was a vigorous John, and a generous one, but whatever illusions existed in their relationship were his, not hers. The numbers came up on the LED register and were saved and time-stamped in their laptop computers. There were 2 of them, and at least 1 more at Tem's house. On each of Solly's phones was a PIN register that noted the destination of every call he made. A similar device did the same for all incoming calls, while 3 tape machines recorded every word. This one was an overseas call, to a mobile phone. "He's calling his friend Mohammed," Peter observed. "I wonder what they'll be talking about. At least 10 minutes of his adventure this weekend, I'll wager." "Yes, he does like to talk," Peter agreed. "She's too skinny, but she is an accomplished harlot, my friend. There is something to be said for unbelieving women," Solly assured his colleague. "She and Rosalie really liked him. He could always tell." "I am glad to hear that, Uda," Mohammed said patiently from Paris. "Now, to business. As you wish, my friend. The American operation went well." "Yes, I saw. How many in total?"
83 dead and 143 wounded. It could have been more, but one of the teams made an error. More importantly, the news reports were everywhere. All they had on TV today was coverage of our holy martyrs and their attacks."
"That is truly wonderful. A great blow for Allah."
"Oh, yes. Now, I need some money transferred into my account."
"How much?"
100,000 British pounds should do for now." I can have that done by 10 in the morning. In fact, he could have had it done an hour or two faster, but he planned on sleeping in the following morning. Mandy had tired him out. Now he was lying in bed, drinking French wine and smoking a cigarette, watching the TV without getting too involved. He wanted to catch Sky News at the top of the hour. Is that all? Yes, for now. It shall be done, he told Mohammed. Excellent. Good night, Uda. Wait, I have a question. Not now. We must be cautious, Mohammed warned. Using a mobile phone had its dangers. He heard a sigh in reply. As you wish. Good night. And both killed their respective phones.
The pub out in Somerset was rather nice. The Blue Boar, it was, said Mandy. The food was decent. Uda had turkey and 2 pints on Friday night. Last night we dined at a restaurant across from the hotel, the Orchard. He had Chateaubriand, and I had the Dover Sole. We went out to shop briefly on Saturday afternoon. He really didn't want to go out much, mostly just wanted to stay in bed.
The cute detective was taping it all, plus making notes, as was another policeman. They both were being as clinical as she was. Did he talk about anything, the news on TV or in the papers?
He watched the news on TV, but he didn't speak a word. I said that it was appalling, all that killing, but all he did was grunt. He can be the most heartless chap, though he's always nice to me. We've still not had a cross word, she told them, caressing both with her blue eyes. It was hard for the cops to regard her with professionalism. She had the looks of a fashion model, though at 5'1" she was too short for it. There was also a sweetness about her that must have stood her in good stead, but inside was a heart of pure ice. It was sad, but not really their concern.
Did he make any telephone calls?
She shook her head. None at all. He didn't bring his mobile phone this weekend. He told me that he was all mine, and I wouldn't have to share him with anyone else this weekend. That was a first. Other than that, it was the usual.
She thought of something else.
He does bathe more now. I had him shower both days, and he didn't even complain. Well, I helped. I went into the shower with him.
She gave them a coquettish smile. That pretty much ended the interview.
Thank you, Miss Davis. As always, you've been very helpful.
Just doing my bit. You think he's a terrorist or something?
She had to ask.
No. If you were in any danger, we'd give you fair warning.
Mandy reached into her Louis Vuitton purse and pulled out a knife with a 5-inch blade. It wasn't legal for her to carry such a thing concealed, but in her line of work she needed one sure friend to accompany her, and the detectives understood. She probably knew how to make proper use of it, they surmised.
I can look after myself, she assured them both, but Uda isn't like that. He's actually rather a gentleman. That's one thing you get to know in my business, reading men. Unless he's a bloody fine actor, he's not a dangerous sort. He plays with money, not guns.
Both cops took that pronouncement seriously. She was right. If there was anything a hooker was good at, it was reading men. Those who couldn't often died before reaching 20. After Mandy took a cab home, the 2 special branch detectives wrote up what she'd told them and then emailed it to Tem's house, where it became another entry in the security service files on the young Arab. Brian and Dominic arrived at the campus at 8 a.m. on the dot. Their newly issued security passes allowed them to take the elevator up to the top floor, where they sat and drank coffee for half an hour, until Jerry Henley showed up. Both of the twins sprang to attention, especially Brian.
"Good morning," the former senator said on his way past. Then he stopped. "You want to talk to Sam Granger first, I think. Rick Pasternak will be here around 9:15. Sam should be in any time now. I have to see to my desk right now, okay?"
"Yes, sir," Brian assured him.
"What the hell? The coffee wasn't bad."
Granger came out of the elevator just 2 minutes later.
"Hey, guys, follow me." And they did.
Granger's office was not as large as Hendley's, but it wasn't a trainee's cubbyhole either. He pointed to the two visitors' chairs and hung up his coat. "How soon will you be ready for an assignment?" "How does today grab you?" Dominic asked in reply. Granger smiled at the reply, but overly eager people could worry him. On the other hand, 3 days before, maybe eagerness was not so bad a thing after all. "Is there a plan?" Brian asked. "Yeah, we worked on it over the weekend." Granger started with the operational concept, reconnaissance by fire. "Makes sense," Brian observed. "Where do we do it?" "On the street, probably. I'm not going to tell you how to perform a mission. I will tell you what we want done. How you do it is going to be up to you. Now, for your first target, we have a good crib sheet on his location and habits. It will just be a matter of identifying the right target and deciding how to do the job." Do the job, Dominic thought, like something from The Godfather. "Who is he and why?" "His name is Uda bin Sali. He's 26. He lives in London." The twins exchanged amused looks. "I should have known," Dominic said. "Jack told us about him. He's the money puke who likes hookers, right?" Granger opened the manila file he'd picked up on the way in and handed it across. "Photos of Sali and his two girlfriends. Location and photos of his house in London. Here's one of him in his car." "Aston Martin," Dominic observed. "Nice wheels." "He works in the financial district, has an office at the Lloyd's insurance building." More photos. "One complication. He usually has a tail. The security service, MI5, keeps an eye on him, but the troop they have assigned seems to be a rookie, and there's only one. So when you make your hit, keep that in mind." "Not using a gun, are we?" Brian asked. "No, we have something better. No noise, nice and covert. You'll see when Rick Pasternak gets here. No firearms for this mission. European countries don't like guns much, and hand-to-hand is too dangerous. The idea is that it looks like he just had a heart attack." "Residue?" Dominic asked. "You can ask Rick about that. He'll give you chapter and verse." "What are we using to deliver the drug?" "One of these." Granger opened his desk drawer and took out the safe blue pen. He handed it across and told them how it worked. "Sweet," Brian observed. "Just stab him in the ass, like." "Exactly right. It transfers 7 milligrams of the drug. It's called succinylcholine, and that pretty much takes care of business. The subject collapses, is brain dead in a few minutes, and all the way dead in less than 10. "What about medical attention? What if there's an ambulance just across the street?" "Rick says it won't matter unless he's in an operating room with doctors standing right at his side." "Fair enough." Brian picked up the photo of their first target, looking at it, but really seeing young David Prentice. "Tough luck, buddy." "I see our friend had a nice weekend," Jack was saying to his computer. This day's report included a photo of a Miss Mandy Davis, along with a transcript of her interview with the Metropolitan Police Special Branch. "She's a looker." "Not cheap either," Wills observed from his workstation. "How much longer is Sali got?" Jack asked him. "Jack, it's better not to speculate on that," Wills warned. "Because the two hitters, hell, Tony, they're cousins of mine." "I do not know much about that, and I do not want to find out. The less we know, the less problems we can have. Period," he emphasized. "You say so, man," Jack responded. "But whatever sympathy I might have had for this prick died when he started cheerleading and funding people with guns. There are lines you can't cross." "Yeah, Jack, there are. Be careful that you don't step too far yourself." Jack Ryan Jr. thought about that for a second. Did he want to be an assassin? Probably not. But there were people who needed killing, and Uda bin Sali had crossed over into that category. If his cousins were going to take him down, they were just doing the Lord's work. Or his country's work, which, to the way he'd been brought up, was pretty much the same thing. "That fast, Doc?" Dominic asked. Pasternak nodded. "That fast." "That reliable?"
Brian inquired next.
5 milligrams is enough. This pen delivers 7. If anyone survives, it would have to be a miracle. Unfortunately, it will be a very unpleasant death, but that can't be helped. I mean, we could use botulism toxin. It's a very fast-acting neurotoxin. But that leaves residue in the blood that would come out in a post-mortem toxicology scan. Succinylcholine metabolizes very nicely. Detecting it would take another miracle, unless the pathologist knows exactly what to look for, and that is unlikely.
How fast, again?
20 to 30 seconds, depending on how close you get to a major blood vessel. Then the agent will cause total paralysis. Won't even be able to blink his eyes. He will not be able to move his diaphragm, so no breathing, no oxygen through the lungs. His heart will continue to beat, but since it will be the organ using the most oxygen, the heart will go ischemic in a matter of seconds. That means that without oxygen, the heart tissue will start to die from lack of oxygen. The pain will be massive. Ordinarily, the body has a reserve supply of oxygen. How much depends on physical condition. The obese have less oxygen reserves than the slender among us. Anyway, the heart will be the first. It will try to continue beating, but that only makes the pain worse. Brain death will occur in 3 to 6 minutes. Until then, he'll be able to hear, but not see.
Why not? Brian asked.
The eyelids probably will close. We're talking total paralysis here. So, he'll be lying there, in enormous pain, unable to move at all, with his heart trying to pump unoxygenated blood until his brain cells expire from anoxia. After that, it's theoretically possible to keep the body alive. Muscle cells last the longest without oxygen, but the brain will be gone. Okay, it's not as sure as a bullet in the brain, but it makes no noise and leaves virtually no evidence. When the heart cells die, they generate enzymes that we look for in a probable heart attack. So, whatever pathologist gets the body to post will think heart attack or neurological seizure. A brain tumor can cause that, and maybe he'll carve the brain up to look for one. But as soon as the blood work comes back, the enzyme test will say heart attack, and that should settle matters right then and there. The blood work will not show the succinylcholine because it metabolizes even after death. They will have an unexpected massive heart attack on their hands, and those happen every day. They'll run his blood for cholesterol and some other risk factors, but nothing will change the fact that he's dead from a cause they'll never figure out.
Jesus, Dominic breathed. Doc, how the hell did you get into this business?
My little brother was a vice president at Cantor Fitzgerald, was all he had to say.
So, we want to be careful with these pens, eh? Brian asked.
The doc's reason was good enough for him.
I would, Pasternak advised them.
Chapter 17 And the Little Red Fox and the First Fence. They flew out of Dulles International Airport on a British Airways flight, which turned out to be a 747 whose control surfaces their own father had designed 27 years earlier. It occurred to Dominic that he'd been in diapers then, and that the world had turned over quite a few times from that day to this. Both had brand new passports in their own names. All other relevant documents were in their laptops, fully encrypted, along with modems and communication software, also fully encrypted. Aside from that, they were casually dressed, like most others in the first-class section. The stewardesses fluttered about efficiently, giving everyone munchies, along with white wine for both of the brothers. As they got to altitude, the food was decent, about the best thing that can be said about airline food, and so was the movie selection. Brian picked Independence Day, while Dominic settled for The Matrix. Both had enjoyed science fiction since childhood. In the coat pockets of both were their gold pens. The reload cartridges were in their shaving kits, packed away in their regular luggage somewhere below. It would be about 6 hours to Heathrow, and both hoped to get some sleep on the way.
"Any second thoughts, Enzo?" Brian asked quietly.
"No," Dominic replied. "Just so it all works out." The prison cells in England lacked plumbing, he didn't add, and no matter how embarrassing it might be for a Marine officer, it would be positively humiliating for a sworn special.